You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of May, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the news agenda with journalist Paolo Tartaro. We'll be looking at the continuing rift between the UK and the EU, immigration as a political hot topic, and how to fund the arts world.
Thousands of secret classified military operations that don't officially ever take place, fought by units that don't officially exist. We talk America's dirty wars with investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill.
When Bill Clinton was president in the 90s, covert operations were viewed as something that could get you in trouble or pulled before the Congress. After 9/11, the gloves came off, and the Bush and Cheney administration began to bring back assassination as a central component of U.S. foreign policy.
Also coming up, ministers from the eight nations of the Arctic meet tomorrow in Kiruna in northern Sweden for a summit of the Arctic Council. Our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield is there already and tells us what to expect.
And on this week's preview of Monocle's Design Programme, Section D, we meet the designers shaping the future of New York's fashion world.
It's tremendous. It's really the hallmark of a four-year education at Pratt. And this thesis, the collection, they work on it all year long.
All that plus some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. A Philadelphia doctor could face the death penalty after being found guilty of murdering three babies during abortions at a clinic serving low-income women. 72-year-old Dr. Kermit Gosnell, who ran the now-closed Women's Medical Society clinic, was accused of delivering live babies during late-term abortions and then deliberately severing their spinal cords. The case focused on whether the infants were born alive and then killed, and it's cast a national spotlight on the controversial practice of late-term abortions. Jack McMahon is Dr. Gosnell's lawyer.
As any intelligent human being would be at this point in time, he's disappointed and he's upset. I mean, we aired out our position on this over a long trial. We had a fair trial. We got to put out our position, and the jury spoke.
In Pakistan, hundreds of demonstrators have been protesting against alleged rigging in the weekend's general election. In the country's biggest city, Karachi, over 500 supporters of cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan staged a sit-in demonstration in one of the main streets leading out to the airport. They're demanding fresh elections wherever the alleged rigging took place. In its preliminary report, the European Union's election observation mission to Pakistan said there had been some shortcomings, but they'd been encouraged by what they'd seen. Michael Gala is head of the mission.
We have assessed this election process to be competitive and improved, despite militant violence and procedural shortcomings. A strong commitment was shown to democracy by state authorities, parties, candidates and voters who continued to participate in the electoral process despite high level of militant attacks in different parts of the country.
Saudi Arabia has confirmed four new cases of the SARS-like novel coronavirus in its eastern province. The health ministry said one of the four new cases had been treated and the patient had been released from hospital. On Sunday, Saudi Arabia said it had had a total of 24 confirmed cases since the disease was identified last year, 15 of them fatal. In the latest outbreak in Eastern Province, it said 15 confirmed cases had been reported, 9 of the cases had died. Authorities in Mexico City have arrested two men in connection with the murder of the grandson of the U.S. civil rights leader Malcolm X. According to authorities, Malcolm Shabazz, who was 29, died of blunt trauma injuries last week. He was at a bar in a rundown area of Mexico City with an immigration activist. The arrested men worked as waiters at the bar. Dozens of Rohingya Muslims have feared to have drowned after a boat carrying about 100 people capsized off western Burma. The boat was assisting a mass evacuation from low-lying regions ahead of Cyclone Mahasan. Officials say the boat struck rocks and sank late on Monday. The UN warned last week that the tropical cyclone could bring life-threatening conditions to thousands of people living in camps in the west of Burma. Their homes were destroyed in violence between majority Buddhists and minority Muslims last year. Walmart has called on the Bangladesh government to stop production at one clothing factory and investigate conditions at another until workers' safety can be assured. The unusual action followed the death of more than 1,100 people in the collapse of a factory in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. Walmart says it stopped production at one factory because it had discovered that a neighbouring building had structural problems. It also said inspectors had reported a potentially dangerous condition at another one of the factories it uses. Walmart has called on other companies to halt production in both factories. The Oscar-winning actress Angelina Jolie has revealed that she's undergone a double mastectomy because a gene mutation increased her risk of developing breast cancer. Writing in the New York Times, she says her decision was the result of her own mother's early death from cancer and the discovery that she carried the BRCA1 gene mutation. She also urges other women to take steps to see if they had a similar risk. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Bonnie, thank you very much. It's 16:06 in Tokyo and 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. It's time now to get ready and set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Joining us today is Paola Totaro, journalist and former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald Saturday. Paola, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
We've got three stories that you've chosen for us. The first one, of course, though, lots of discussion over the UK's role within the European Union.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's become really the story of the week, hasn't it? With David Cameron with some very serious problems as various cabinet ministers and backbenchers have suggested that they will vote against. So he's now been forced into a tactical decision to put forward a parliamentary bill, MP's bill, to ensure that they feel comfortable that this referendum will happen. But it's such a pity, I think. It's just such a sad debate. I believe.
And of course, Obama giving that critical high profile backing. How significant do you think that will be for Cameron?
I think that was extremely significant. The leader of the free world doesn't usually get involved in domestic politics. But, you know, the EU is such an important experiment. It was an experiment post-war. And I remember reading Tony Jute, that wonderful historian who died recently, who called it, a utterly original animal, the EU. Very disparate, but, a symbol of unity post-war, of rebuilding of spirit. And it just seems such a sad thing to think of its pullout.
And you would think this is a European issue, but President Obama is weighing in as well. David Cameron was in D.C. yesterday, and Obama said at a news conference that, they should fix this relationship before, quote, breaking it off. What do you think's behind this?
Well, as I said, it was an experiment, an experiment in unity post-war. The EU the common markets were designed to try and bring all these countries together that were ravaged by war. And obviously America's looking on and seeing this big economic and political animal that needs to stay together, that needs unity, that, we're allies after all.
He wouldn't be drawn, though, on some of Cameron's reforms for the EU that he has in mind. Certainly a, a lot more low-key in his support for those, so realistic probably about the difficulty he'll face in pushing them through.
Absolutely. And I think also there's a great tradition of external, of leaders outside of you know, big democracies not getting, putting their noses in other people's business. But I think the very point that he said something in public is very important to Cameron and you know, politically will be heeded, I suspect.
And also the US is in the midst of negotiating some kind of a free trade agreement with the European Union. How important is the economics of this?
Clearly very important, you know, to maintain those ties and to ensure that, you know, both all economies on either side of the Atlantic are in deep doo-doo, let's face it. So, you know, anything that will re-stimulate and toughen ties, or, you know, make ties stronger is terribly important.
And, of course, immigration central to the European debate, also key in younger nations such as Australia at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, I notice this very much as an outsider, even though I've been here for a long time. My sense is how unified and multicultural this big city is and this country is. And yet it's fairly clear that everywhere in the world, when economies are under the gun, that ultimately, sadly, people look to outsiders to blame for the problems. And so austerity, whether it be here, Germany, you know, Australia, which has a buoyant economy, is also, you know, fearing, fear of the outsider, really. So it's flavouring political debate the world over, unfortunately.
Do you think our political leaders, perhaps in Europe, the UK, and even in Australia, are they missing a beat by not standing more resolutely with immigrant populations and standing more resolutely for people coming to their country?
I personally do. I mean, I am an immigrant myself, and Australia is a nation of immigrants. So the notion that you start closing your borders or even speaking as if your borders are going to be closed to refugees, to asylum seekers, I don't think it's a great way for the discourse to go. However, politicians have to be, you know, reasonable and ultimately there's clearly an issue with citizens who feel that there's too much going on, so...
Moving onto France now, where, of course, there have been diplomatic clashes as well on the ground over immigration. There's also a controversy now over an innovative, perhaps controversial, depending on how you see it, suggestion of a new tax on technology. How's that being received and covered?
Well, I found this really, really intriguing and quite out there. You know, all over the world. In fact, there was a very good piece in the FT yesterday, I think, about the fact that as we are in austere times, that often the first things that go in budgets are what are regarded as not, you know, essential, i.e. the arts. And yet, you know, for example, the British economy is booming because of the arts. Billions come in and, you know, museums, I mean, that's what you trade on. So in France, similar issues, and there they're talking about raising funds by putting a tax on smartphones and technology, which I thought was really, really interesting. But obviously there's been a massive backlash from Google and Apple, and they're all going berserk.
So they're recommending that they put a 1% tax on the purchase price of tablets, smartphones, any kind of high-tech gear you might get in France. So you said the reaction there in France has been very against this idea, but there must be some, perhaps even those in the arts and culture world, that think this is maybe a good idea. 1% is a very small price to pay if you want to continue having, you know, considering your country to be a cultural leader in the world.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that if Britain's a good example where the public broadcaster BBC is actually funded by a similar tax, you know, your TV licence. So I mean, personally, I think it's a really interesting idea to debate. And I think if they packaged it and looked at other parts of the world where, you know, money is raised in similar ways, perhaps I'd get it across, but let's face it, it's not a good time for Hollande, is it?
We've seen, of course, in the UK, there's been a lot of dispute over tax loopholes, which the likes of Google have been able to capitalise on. Do you think in France it might deter that big business investment, which their economy quite frankly needs at the moment?
Potentially, but yes. I mean, obviously that is a risk. But I think that if the government is smart about their rhetoric and if they package it in a correct way, I think people would probably support it. You just tell them what you might shut down or what you might not see anymore for free, and use that as the carrot.
And just very quickly, do you support this idea? Would you pay 1%? Would you be happy paying 1% tax?
I'm a big supporter of the arts, and I hate budgets, you know, austerity budgets always going for the arts first. So absolutely, yes.
Okay, made. Not sitting on the fence on that one. Paola Tatari, thank you very much indeed for joining us, journalist and former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald Saturday.
Coming up, we head north to Kiruna, where a summit of the Arctic Council takes place tomorrow.
The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
Now, it is perhaps one of the most desolate places on the planet, but the Arctic is playing a more important role as sea lanes continue opening and resource-rich land is revealed. It's one of the reasons why this year's meeting of the Arctic Council in Kiruna, Sweden, is of particular importance.
Ministers from the eight nations of the Arctic will meet Wednesday to discuss a range of topics, including new passage links, global warming, tourism, and of course, the lucrative natural resources. Also on the agenda, whether to admit new countries, including China. Well, joining us on the line is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who is in Kiruna. Now, Steve, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this meeting, tell me a bit about... you're having a bit of trouble with the light, I understand.
It just doesn't get dark here, Phil. It just doesn't get dark. We got here last night. I'm told it was at about 11 p.m. at night, but it was pretty bright outside. We are pretty much as far north as you can get and still be in civilization. Kiruna's a town of about 18,000 people, right at the northernmost tip of Sweden. And in the summer months in June and July, the sun doesn't set at all. Right now, we have about 2 hours of supposed darkness, but even then, still quite bright.
Well, moving from the weather to the dark art of politics and the Arctic Council, Steve, a rare success story on the diplomatic circuit.
It is, yes. It set up in 1996, and it's the eight nations that have part of the Arctic within their territory. So the US, Russia, Canada, and then the five Nordic nations. And they work pretty well. We were at the last meeting of the Arctic Council in Haparanda in Sweden just before Christmas for a story which was in Monocle Alpino. And what was striking about it was that you saw, particularly Russia and the US, two countries that have a lot of disagreements diplomatically, working very closely together on a number of key issues. So they've got issues over oil and minerals. They've got issues over climate change and the environment. And of course, as well, one big issue, which is going to be discussed a lot tomorrow, as the ice caps begin to melt, you've also got this northern sea routes opening up, which will allow ships and tankers to cross from Europe to Asia, not via the Suez Canal, but north, right over the top.
And Steve, that is perhaps one of the reasons why China, I think, is playing such an important role in this, at least voicing its interest in this meeting. There's some discussion over whether to admit China as an observer or even perhaps even as a participant. What's been the reaction there where you are over this?
So we've got these eight main members of the Arctic Council, and yet apart from that, there are a number of unofficial observers. So so China is one of those, Japan is one as well, Korea, countries like Spain are unofficial observers as well. And so what that means is that they're allowed to attend certain meetings, but they can't really have their say. And what a lot of them are saying is, well, we'd like to have a more of a formal role and be involved a little bit more. And there's a bit of a split within the council itself over whether to let those, particularly China, join. So the Nordic nations are all for it. Russia and Canada are against. The US at the moment appears to be somewhat on the fence. And that's going to be one of the main issues to be discussed tomorrow. Because, I mean, as you say, you know, China has, although it's, you know, quite a distance from the Arctic, it sees what happens here as being incredibly important for them, not just for that sea route that I just mentioned, but also they're investing a lot in Iceland. There's talk of them investing in Greenland as well. There's a lot of minerals in this region, and China could do with them.
And of course, as well as the issues of big business, Steve, this of course represents indigenous groups. A lot of talk about the arts world as well, and a coalition on bringing, for instance, natural history museums together and combining forces over that.
Indeed, and I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this organisation is that it's not just you know, ministers sat around the table, that all the indigenous communities are involved as well. They have, you know, they're all sat at that table with everyone else. Canada is taking over the chairmanship of the Arctic Council at the end of this meeting. So for the next 2 years, Canada will be the chair. And one of the things that they're pushing is the idea of a natural history museum, which really focuses on the Arctic, which all eight nations get involved in.
Well, Steve Bloomfield in Kiruna, thank you very much indeed, Monocle's foreign editor.
Now, it may read more like a Tom Clancy spy novel than the actual military operations of the United States. Thousands of secret missions that don't officially ever happen and don't even officially exist. Welcome to the world of America's secret war. Investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill has, however, gone into that world and released a new book titled Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield.
Yet the operations he discusses were facilitated by Rumsfeld, Cheney and Bush. But President Obama stepped them up. He started what US officials described as Terror Tuesdays on the agenda were kill lists with the names of people America considered a threat. Well, Jeremy Scahill describes these as a form of pre-crime in his book. He spent 5 years doing the research for it and spoke to Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove.
You could say that it started at the founding of our republic, when the, you know, the nation was founded on the idea that Native Americans could be exterminated so that the Pilgrims could establish footholds. As a matter of national security policy, to put it in the context of the modern world, after World War II, the Naval Intelligence Organization called the OSS transformed into the CIA. And beginning in the early 1950s, the CIA involved itself in overthrowing various governments and targeting populist movements and assassinating various political figures in throughout Africa and Latin America. It sort of became official U.S. policy that you would have a set of forces within the U.S. government that could be used to do extremely dirty business. In the 1970s, after a spate of assassinations that started in the 50s and spanned all the way through the 70s, the U.S. Congress finally sort of decided to do something about it. And so they formed a commission in the Senate called the Church Committee, which was headed by a senator named Frank Church of Idaho, and began to sort of try to dismantle what many in the U.S. Congress felt was sort of an out-of-control killing program. And so the generation of leaders who were running the CIA when Bill Clinton was president in the 90s had all been educated in a system where covert operations were viewed as something that could get you in trouble or pulled before the Congress. After 9/11, the gloves came off, and the Bush and Cheney administration began to bring back assassination as a central component of U.S. foreign policy. When Barack Obama became president, I think there was a perception that he was going to bring an end to the torture, to Guantanamo, to the CIA black sites. And, you know, what we see 5 years into his administration is that in many cases, all he's done is sort of rejigger the language used to describe the programs and, in fact, has accelerated the U.S. assassination program.
And the book is an amazing, very in-depth study looking really at post 9/11. I wondered, you know, how you started researching this book, and you know, by its nature, so much of this is off the record and secret. Do you, as a journalist and as an investigative journalist, how much work did you really have to put in to get to the the essence of what the book really reveals.
Right, yeah, yeah. The first book that I wrote was a book about Blackwater, which was this mercenary company that became famous in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they became famous because of a series of incidents where they ended up shooting bunches of innocent Iraqis and in some cases Afghans as well. But behind the sort of public scandal that played out, what we discovered is that Blackwater had been deeply involved in the CIA's assassination program starting very early after 9/11. They had farmed together a team of men that could do operations that would be off the books. In some cases, the owner of Blackwater, Eric Prince, would actually fund operations himself. And it was sort of an ideal deniable force for the CIA to use. After I wrote that book, I started to get approached by people within the U.S. military special operations community who would come up to me at events or send me emails and say, you know, I don't particularly like your politics and you seem to be against these wars, but you got it right about that company. They didn't like Blackwater, the people from the conventional military, because they saw them as mercenaries who were being paid more than U.S. soldiers. And so I started to develop source relationships with a number of people who were working on the targeted killing program. And as I started to explore their world, I would research where they were hitting and then started to take trips to these places. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, Yemen and Afghanistan. I also was in Somalia, where the U.S. is waging a sort of proxy war against the militant movement al-Shabaab by using a network of warlords and sort of paid assassins to hunt down people that have been identified by the White House as potential threats against the United States or against regional security in East Africa. You know, a lot of it is a matter of physically going to a place. I mean, it, you know, as journalists, it's very difficult to report from a cubicle in Washington, D.C. or London or New York or wherever on events that are happening on the ground, particularly when there are no journalists there. So, you know, part of what I sought out to do in this book was to tell a multidimensional story, tell the story of the operators who do the killing on behalf of the U.S., but also tell the story of the people that they're targeting, along with the civilians that are caught in between, and that requires going to these places.
And in terms of the ethics of war, it's a complicated conversation and indeed a topic to write about. Do you think that this element of assassination makes the foreign policy that we've seen over the last decade even more complex and toxic? And right. How does it differ from conventional war?
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about the title of the book, you know, Dirty Wars, it wasn't to sort of be the master of the obvious that there like that there's no such thing as a clean war. But part of it is a pushback on this idea that's been promoted by President Obama and his team that they're waging a smarter war, a cleaner war, that the drone strikes are surgical, that they're systematically taking out the leadership of al-Qaeda and other movements. And a tremendous number of terror leaders have been killed under the Obama administration. But what I found on the ground is that the U.S. will bomb an area of Yemen, and maybe they'll take someone out that's on a list, and maybe they misfire. But they're killing a tremendous number of innocent people. The dirtiest aspect to me is the fact that we appear to be making more new enemies than we are killing known terrorists. You know, part of my motivation for writing this is that I think that we ignore the impact of our policy at our own peril. And we have to learn lessons from 9/11 and from the motivation of people that may want to do harm to us. It's not that they hate us for our freedom and our McDonald's. I mean, we're giving people a legitimate reason to want to strike back at us. And that's the worst thing you can do if you're fighting against an adversary, is to aid their cause by giving them a recruitment tool. And that's what our drone strike policy has largely become, I think.
And the book is very unique in some senses that it goes into the lives of some of the characters involved in a lot of detail. You're looking at Anwar al-Awlaki, who's in Yemen, who is a very controversial figure. From researching his story, do you think that you really found out more about this blowback you're talking about, this cyclical nature of the hitlist mentality in foreign policy?
I remember seeing Anwar al-Awlaki on television after 9/11, because he was the head of a very large mosque in the U.S. state of Virginia, and he was condemning the 9/11 attacks on TV, very fiery, passionate speech, and saying that al-Qaeda had perverted Islam and that the United States had a right to bring those responsible to justice. And he was sort of trying to help major media outlets make sense of the experience of American Muslims. On the one hand, condemning the 9/11 attacks. On the other hand, trying to say, whoa, let's not have a witch hunt against all of Islam. And al-Awlaki, the story I tell in the book from getting to know his family and digging into his archives, was a guy who saw Abu Ghraib and saw Guantanamo and saw the invasion of Iraq as attacks against Islam. And so you fast forward to a number of years after the initial invasion of Iraq, and al-Awlaki had become a guy who was on YouTube and the internet calling for armed jihad against the United States. And ultimately, he became the first U.S. citizen that we know of who was directly targeted for assassination by President Obama, who is a constitutional law professor, a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And for me, there shouldn't be a difference between American or non-American citizens on a moral level. But if a society is willing to deprive its own citizens of the most basic right to have a trial or to face its accusers, then what do you think their standard is going to be for people in Pakistan or Yemen? In a two-week period in late 2011, President Obama authorized operations that killed three U.S. citizens, Awlaki and another American named Samir Khan. And then 2 weeks later, Anwar Awlaki's 16-year-old son was blown up in a drone attack. The White House has never explained why they killed his son. And I know from all the time I spent with that family and going through countless interviews with his friends, with his aunts and uncles, this was a kid who had nothing to do with terrorism. So for me, and the reason why it's sort of the spine of the book is that it was a moment where we crossed a line. If this can happen under a popular Democratic president, what happens the next time a Bush or Cheney type figure is in office in the United States?
Your book comes out really very soon after what we saw in Boston.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's been received differently because of that? Because of what we saw, this idea of an American citizen radicalized by events that were largely caused by American foreign policy. Do you think that you might have a more sympathetic audience or a different reception to the book because of what happened in Boston?
On the one hand, the book has gotten a lot of attention and it's done well. I mean, it was number 5 on the New York Times list, which I'm not raising that to say, yay me. I'm raising it to say I think a lot of people are interested in this topic right now. But I've also been attacked from very conservative angles in the U.S. And, what I would say is that we don't actually know the motivation of the Boston Marathon bombers. I mean, this is part of the problem with our media culture in the U.S. Everything is done through leaks. And there's been all this information leaked. This kid who's in custody right now in Boston is a suspect in a crime. He has not been convicted. There's been no evidence presented against him that he's been able to respond to with lawyers. We are sort of deteriorating as a society into a mentality at times where the mob comes out in the streets with pitchforks and says, let's deliver citizens justice. Anwar Awlaki, who we were talking about earlier, this American citizen who was assassinated on orders from the president of the United States, to me, it's not about who is he. It's about who are we as a nation. We portray ourselves as like this shining city on atop the hill. Well, if there are certain people that we think the mob should just be able to go out and lynch without charging them with a crime, then we should stop telling people that we're this awesome rule of law. My response to the Boston Marathon bombing is the same as my response to 9/11. I want the perpetrators brought to justice. But I don't think you deliver justice with pitchforks and torches anymore. You have to have some moral upper ground against those that you claim to be these great threats. I mean, it really is about the soul of our nation much more than it is about who these individual terrorists are or criminals are.
An attack on the U.S. homeland, though, is exactly what all of these assassinations and this dirty war that you've talked about has been trying to prevent. So do you think that the events that happened in Boston will change people's mind about what's been going on beyond American borders?
I'm more concerned about the fact that we are a nation full of people with semi-automatic weapons, some of which have been used to go in and slaughter 5-year-old children in the most senseless way possible. Americans shooting other Americans with guns far surpasses anything that any jihadist in the mountains of Yemen could dream up. For me, I mean, I look at it as an American in a community with a lot of school children. I mean, I'm more concerned about loony bins with guns coming in and shooting our children in our community than I am someone bringing down an aircraft. And I actually think our foreign policy increases the likelihood someone will want to blow up a U.S. airplane. If Martians were to land on planet Earth and just sort of review the way that Americans conduct their affairs and where their priorities are, I mean, the amount of money that we spend fighting a relatively small group of admittedly dangerous people compared to our gun policy, we would look like insane people. We would look like we are just absolutely crazy.
That was Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, speaking to Monocle's senior editor there, Sophie Grove.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we visit one of America's top fashion institutions, shaping the next generation of skilled designers.
It's tremendous. It's really the hallmark of a four-year education at Pratt. And this thesis, the collection, they work on it all year long.
We also continue this week's series on Eurovision and go through today's Canadian papers. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Cordelia. A Philadelphia doctor could face the death penalty after being found guilty of murdering 3 babies during abortions at a clinic serving low-income women. 72-year-old Dr. Kermit Gosnell was accused of delivering live babies during late-term abortions and then deliberately severing their spinal cords. In Pakistan, hundreds of demonstrators have taken to the streets to protest against the alleged rigging in the weekend's general election. Saudi Arabia has confirmed four new cases of the SARS-like novel coronavirus in its eastern province. The health ministry said one of the cases had been treated and the patient had been released from hospital. Authorities in Mexico City have arrested two men in connection with the murder of the grandson of the US civil rights leader Malcolm X. The authorities say 29-year-old Malcolm Shabazz died of blunt trauma injuries early last Thursday. Dozens of Rohingya Muslims are feared to have drowned after a boat carrying about 100 people capsized off western Burma. The boat was assisting a mass evacuation from low-lying regions ahead of a tropical cyclone. Walmart has called on the Bangladeshi government to stop production at one clothing factory and investigate conditions at another until workers' safety can be assured. The Oscar-winning actress Angelina Jolie has revealed that she's undergone a double mastectomy because a gene mutation increased her risk of developing breast cancer. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Phil Han. Our next story takes us to New York for a look at some of America's top fashion talent and an institution shaping the next generation of skilled designers. Founded in 1887, Brooklyn's Pratt Institute is home to America's oldest fashion design program and recently hosted its 114th annual fashion presentation.
Showcasing more than a dozen collections, this year's runway show offered a glimpse of bold designs and conceptual pieces. It also offered the Institute an opportunity to award American designer Tom Brown with its annual Fashion Visionary Award. We sent Monocle's Barrett Austin along to find out more for this week's edition of Section D.
New York's Pratt Institute is home to America's oldest academic program teaching students the art of fashion design. For more than a century, graduating design students have been selected to participate in the school's annual fashion show. With a pervasive energy not unlike the catwalk shows of New York's own Fashion Week, Pratt's student presentation showcased the school's top talents, a number of collections that evolve over the fourth and final year for a handful of talented design students. Jennifer Minitti is the head of Pratt's fashion design program. After the final hoots and hollers of the recent show, we met atop the catwalk for a brief chat. I started by asking about all the effort that goes into making the collections a reality.
It's tremendous. I don't know what's more difficult. They work on this. It's really the hallmark of a four-year education at Pratt. And this thesis, the collection, they work on it all year long. I'm sometimes amazed every year that it happens, and it happens brilliantly, and with impeccable craft, and that the students are really responsible for the head-to-toe look. So it's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Like many university-level presentations, Pratt's fashion show hands students a considerable degree of challenge. But it also offers soon-to-be fashion graduates an opportunity to showcase a full runway collection to a host of influential designers, journalists, and possibly even buyers who fill several hundred chairs in the Chelsea warehouse where the show is presented. Minitti's opinion suggests that the fashion show is very much a lasting hallmark for her students.
They may never get this chance again. Before the show, they participate in a jury over at Canoe Studios, and they show their collection to a panel of experts in the industry. And that in itself is a great experience. And then to come here and to show some of the most important people their collections is a real privilege, and they deserve it.
Among the most conceptual designs offered at this year's presentation, the work of student Sam O'Brien offered an unusual, albeit beautifully turned out collection that's the culmination of more than 12 months of hard work. I ask O'Brien about his inspiration.
My collection was inspired by my time in Iceland. I lived there over the summer, interning with a designer, and just the textures that surrounded me, I just developed into a lot of fabric manipulations, and just the silhouette kind of organically came up, like introduced itself to me.
While many of O'Brien's works appeared somewhat approachable, several designs were purely conceptual explorations of fabrication and silhouette. Here's O'Brien again on his process.
My most conceptual pieces, I developed just a technique of taking silk file and saturating it with wax and scraping away the excess, which turned into very stiff fabric, but when like creased, it made itself to look like ice. So, of course, that's a very literal interpretation of what I saw myself in Iceland. I also experimented with rubbers and resins, just to, with the secondhand concept of developing these textures that represent the natural environment, but with very synthetic material.
And while the spotlight firmly shone on the students who were soon to graduate, Pratt Institute also took time to honor American designer Tom Brown with its Fashion Visionary Award. Over the past decade, Brown has amassed a cult following across the world, best known for his neatly tailored, mid-century-inspired aesthetic. I spoke with Brown about the award just before he took to the stage to receive his honors.
Any type of award amongst your peers, and especially from an institution that really is so important in the world of design, is special.
And while it's altogether fitting that Mr. Brown received Pratt's award, some in attendance were quick to note that the designer himself had never studied fashion in school, but rather learned the skills on the job. I ask how he responds to young designers who cite his example as a reason not to study fashion at university.
Well, they're right. I mean, they can. I think anybody can do whatever they want. But be serious about it and definitely do it because you really want to actually design and make clothes. Don't do it for the fame or for the money, because most likely that's not going to happen.
For Monocle, in New York, I'm Barrett Austin.
And of course, you can catch more from the world of design on this week's edition of Section D. That is at 1900 hours London time today.
Looking forward to it. We'll be right back after this, the second installment of our series looking at the Eurovision. Today, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a self-confessed fan of the contest, tells us what's coming up at today's first semi-final. And we also hear one historical entry that's got a lot of attention.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Oralogical showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Cordelia Lynch. The time is 17:42, excuse me, in Melbourne. It's 8:42 in the morning here in London. Now, the countdown is on. It's nearly time for this weekend's Eurovision finale. And to celebrate, we're marking the singing contest with a special week-long series. Now, if you weren't excited already, Cordelia, I know you're a big fan, aren't you?
I am indeed, although the British contribution hasn't been well received.
Well, I'm sure you'll be glued to your television screens this evening, because 16 countries from Ireland to Slovenia will be battling for their place in the final on tonight's Eurovision Song Contest semi-final.
Yeah, and our Eurovision expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, has come up with a guide to the first semi-final of the contest. Here's what he had to say.
So, the big party starts today. The first semi-final of the Eurovision Song Contest happens tonight in Malmö. 16 countries will fight for a place in the final on Saturday evening. The second semi-final takes place on Thursday. Don't know who are the contestants? Not to worry. This is your guide for tonight's show and who you should be supporting. It's Eurovision. But yes, for those in Brazil, why not support Natalia Kelly with the song Shine, representing Austria? She has Brazilian and North American roots and performs a conventional teen ballad. But hey, It's just her debut single.
When you almost stop believing, cold, alone and freezing, you think you're lost and don't know where to go. Look up to the starlit sky.
For those who need something a bit more up-tempo, there are plenty of options. From Slovenia's club track Straight Into Love,
Straight Into Love, we'll break through the dawn and light the world up from the sky when we collide,
to the fascinating Montenegrin hip-hop of Who See with Ingranka. And there's always the Irish. They've won the contest 7 times, more than anyone else. But are they ready for an 8th win? I'm not too sure about that. But maybe the trancy Only Love Survives by Ryan Dolan will make the cut.
And even if the sun
talk about favorites now. The young Emily DeForest, representing Denmark, is among the contenders this year. It has to be mentioned that she doesn't wear shoes in her performance. Only Teardrops is a good song and quite current, something you could definitely see on the charts of today.
Why do we make it so hard? Look at us now. We only got ourselves to blame. It's such a shame. How many times can we win and lose? Can we break the rules between us? Only teardrops. How many times do we have to fight? How many times do we get it right between us? Only teardrops.
A personal favorite of today's semi-final is the girl group from Serbia called Moje 3. Some sort of mixture of Girls Aloud and K-pop. I like it. That's it for today. Enjoy this evening's semi-final, and on Thursday, there's more. For Monocle, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Wow, what a selection. Do you have a favorite, Phil?
Well, I was just saying that I was a big fan of the Irish singer Ryan Dolan.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're Irish, so you should probably have your allegiances to him.
I should, but
you didn't seem that impressed.
No, not yet, but I was quite a fan of the Serbian entry. Yeah, is that
K-pop
embarrassing?
K-pop slash the Girls Aloud.
Yeah, the description didn't sell it, did it?
Yeah, maybe stick with Ireland.
Well, that was the guide for tonight's semi-final. And on Thursday, we'll have the second guide. So plenty more options to have a listen to.
Lots more to come. I know Fernando's very excited. And of course, to celebrate all things Eurovision, we decided that we'd play some songs here on Midori House. And I believe that this is another personal favorite of Fernando's. This is the Ukrainian 2007 entry, Verka Serdushka, with Dancing Lasha Tumbe. The song was runner-up, just losing out to Serbia. But it has to be said, it probably was one of the more memorable songs of that evening.
Hello everybody, my name is Verka Serdushka. Me English, Nick Verstehen. Let's speak dance, dance, dance. Oh,
That was the Ukrainian Eurovision entry from 2007, Dancing Lashka Tumbai by Verka Saduchka. And tomorrow we continue our Eurovision series with a look at the politics of the competition, both when it comes to voting patterns and countries deciding whether to participate or not.
And in the studio we're joined, he's not from Europe, he's a fellow Canadian, but I understand a huge, huge Eurovision fan.
Of
David
course,
Michon.
Yes. I don't think you can spend very much time in Europe without becoming a Eurovision fan.
And what did you think of that one, the Ukrainian?
It was abrasive.
I thought you were going to be diplomatic there.
No, I don't think you can be diplomatic when it comes to Eurovision. But yes, but you have to anticipate that some of them are going to piss you off.
And do you have any favorites?
Of course. Yeah. My favorite should be your favorite.
Who's that? My favorite, I'm not going to... It's Jedward.
No, 1988, Celine Dion.
She was in Eurovision?
She won for Switzerland, yeah.
Really?
Ne partez pas sans moi was her song.
Interesting.
Well, staying with the musical theme, in the papers, of course, and the astronaut, the Canadian astronaut,
yes,
returning.
Chris Hadfield yesterday landed in Kazakhstan after 5 months as the commander of the International Space Station. Space Station. I'll get there eventually. He was the first Canadian to hold the post, and he, he's been credited kind of internationally in the press for kind of reinvigorating people's interest in outer space. So he's quite famous for a number of reasons. A number of tweets and YouTube videos which he's posted, also doing a music video to David Bowie's Space Oddity, which was
very
successful.
Changing the words up as well. I wonder if he'll be returning to a record deal.
The very first music video from space.
Well, it's cool. One of the things that you mentioned he's really well known is for kind of his YouTube videos and things like that, and I had a look at it a couple of days ago, and he does these amazing kind of experiments in space. So like, what happens when you actually brush your teeth in space? What happens if you try to wring out a sponge full of water? Yeah. And they are amazing videos.
Yeah, of course. And I think, it sometimes just takes one personality to kind of bring to light actually how incredible this experience is. And of course, there's obviously judgments to be made about how expensive, these kind of ventures are and what we're really getting out of them. But, certainly he's kind of like living the astronaut's dream of
Is he a bit of a hero to you?
Well, I think it's always a proud moment when a Canadian gets into the press for, some good reasons. I think that
I agree.
It's good for our country, good brand power.
And because sort of on a more serious point, do you think he'll help sort of lift the profile of the Canadians in space by what he's done?
Well, I mean, did you know he was Canadian?
Well, I have to be honest, I didn't. I did know he had a good pair of pipes in him, but
exactly.
That was it.
So maybe we need to do a little bit more work about PRing our people out there. But I think, it's good. I think it's a good face for Canada. And in fact, randomly, we have some interesting kind of contributions to space programs. Of course, the Canada arm. Yeah, a very appropriately named piece of space technology developed in Canada. So it's nice. There is a very significant aerospace industry in the country, and so it's nice that there's a personality to kind of be a face of it.
And staying in Canada, of course, an interesting development over the 1968 incident on an LL flight and a Palestinian man.
Yes. So Mahmoud Mohammed Issa Mohammed has been living in Canada since for 26 years. Or he was told 26 years ago that he'd be deported. So he was a man that hijacked or took over an LL flight, and along with another man eventually kind of killed an Israeli passenger on that flight. He was then sentenced and held prisoner in Greece and released after another hijacking incident where his release was negotiated, eventually made it to Canada. And if you look to, this is on the Globe and Mail, Deported to Make a Point is the headline. So I think the federal government, run by the Conservatives, is trying to make a point about how strict they've become on immigration and these types of deportation cases that are currently going on in the country. Of course, in the 1980s, Phil, you might know this, quite famously, Canada had a very open immigration policy, essentially. If you came to a Canadian border official, said you were a refugee, you became a permanent resident. And the current government, along with a lot of governments around the world, is becoming very, serious about immigration policy. And I think they and particularly in Canada's relationship with the United States, where we've benefited from a very porous and open border, to have that kind of be shut down systematically as the United States kind of becomes more concerned with how liberal Canada's have become, or how liberal we are seen to be in terms of immigration. So this, for the conservative government, probably has a lot of ramifications in terms of our relationship with other countries as well.
And this comes after 26 years of appeals. The immigration minister, Jason Kenney's quoted as saying that he made a mockery of Canada's generosity and our fair immigration system for 2.5 decades. Strident words there.
Obviously, I think, I'm not trying to be sympathetic to this man at all, but I think there is, there is a responsibility for countries like Canada to take a role, to have these types of things, obviously undergo due process. Maybe this is a bit kind of maybe overdue process.
And David, later today, you'll be, of course, producing The Briefing, which is on at 12 o'clock midday London time. But there's a story you'll be covering on that program. Just give us a quick little sneak peek. It's a fascinating one.
I've plucked this from the Ottawa Citizen. The think tank Samara, which is actually Toronto-based, did an analysis of all of the words spoken in Canadian Parliament, nearly 8 million of them, to decide kind of who was the most verbose, the motor mouths versus the kind of strong and silent types. And of course, there were a few examples. Interestingly, some of the Conservative ministers have been very quiet in Parliament. Jim Flaherty, the Finance Minister, and Rob Nicholson, the Justice Minister, amongst the most quiet. And as you might expect, Elizabeth May, who's the leader of the Green Party, one of the most verbose. Speaking more than all of the other party leaders combined.
Well, on the list is quite interesting because there's not many party leaders on this list, main party leaders at least, or senior cabinet officials or opposition leaders. They're all kind of backbench MPs, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess who use the parliament to kind of get their message out. So question, what is the most appropriate platform for politicians, what they're using.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have. But thanks for having a flick through the Canadian papers for us, David. That's all the time we have. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Lillian Hess. Our studio manager was the very capable Alex Funnell. Next, after the news, is The Entrepreneurs, Monocle's business show. Briefing will be hosted by Robert Bound, and that will be at 2000 hours Tokyo time, midday time if you are in London. But from me, Phil Hahn,
and me, Cordelia. We'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.